Let's pick up where we left off in the book of Leviticus. We left off in chapter 19. Once again, it's just a continuation of some of these various laws that God is setting forth. Now, it's very important that when we do go through this book of Leviticus, especially the latter part of this book, we've got to make a distinction between the ceremonial laws that God sets forth and the moral laws, because the moral laws are still very much intact in terms of God's command that we need to keep these moral laws. The ceremonial laws we are no longer under, and we've got to sometimes exercise a great deal of discernment of what falls into what classification. But I think that if we take every scripture in light of all other scripture, it becomes pretty clear. Beginning with verse 1 in chapter 19, it says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, and say to them, You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." This is a command. This isn't an option. And holiness can be summed up basically in one word, and that's being separated. In other words, we have to be separated from the world as far as its values, as far as its philosophies, as far as its what's important to the world. In other words, we have to live in the world, but we're not of the world. We have to be separated in the sense that we cannot hold the world's values. If we're going to be holy, we really have to make a concerted effort to get away from what the world holds as valuable or something that they look upon as being worthwhile, because God looks at it and despises it. Okay, the value system of the world. All we have to do is look around and see what the world values, and we need to separate ourselves from that. And in doing so, I think that we are going to become holy. But it's not just simply a negative thing of refraining from doing certain things. We are also, holiness is a very positive thing in terms of what are we doing, because God in His holiness, He's holy not simply because He's sinless, but He's holy because He is goodness. In other words, when He said that when He's going to separate the sheep from the goats, when He comes back to this earth, He says that He's going to question the people, saying, "Hey, I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was sick, I was naked, I was in prison, and what did you do for me?" In other words, it's holiness involves far more than just refraining from evil. There's got to be a positive goodness that's generated there through our actions. So that's what he means here, "Be holy, for I am holy." And that's a command. That's not an option. Then in verse 3, it says, "Every one of you shall reverence his mother and his father, and you shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God." Now, you know, he throws in this commandment here, honor your father and your mother. Okay, well, this is a command. It's the only command with basically a promise to it. And the people who honor their mother and father will receive a long, good life. Now, again, I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but obviously I've known people who have honored their mother and father who have died young. There's no question about it. But in a sense, generally speaking, if you honor your parents, you're going to live a long, good life, because your parents, if they love you, they're obviously going to give you good advice and good counsel. And if you follow their good advice and good counsel, you're going to keep yourself out of prison, or you're going to keep yourself from getting diseased, you're going to keep yourself from engaging in reckless activity or all kinds of different things that can shorten your life. So generally speaking, when you honor your parents, it's going to be a natural byproduct of doing that, okay? It's just simply because God is going to bless you for it. And then he says here in verse 4, it says, "Do not turn to idols or make for yourselves molten gods, for I am the Lord your God." And again, he throws in another commandment here. Basically, that's the first commandment. "I am the Lord thy God. I shall not have any strange gods before me." And again, you know, he says, don't turn to idols. In other words, anything that we put before God obviously can become an idol. And today, our society, our culture, our world, but our nation in particular, is just flooded and gutted with idols. People are bowing down and doing homage to all kinds of idols, whether it be greed or materialism or money or sex or entertainment. You name it. It's become an idol. Because why? Because these are things that maybe even things that are in and of themselves are good, but we put them before God, and consequently they have become idols. And he says here in verse 5, says, "Now when you offer a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord, you shall offer it so that you may be accepted. It shall be eaten in the same day you offer it and the next day, but what remains until the third day shall be burned with fire." Okay, now he's talking about here a peace offering. When you bring a sacrifice to God, you know, a peace offering is something where the priest got a portion, God got a portion, and the offerer got a portion. But God said this, okay, when you bring this kind of offering, the portion that you receive, you need to consume it in 2 days. And anything that hasn't been consumed in 2 days, you need to burn the rest with fire. Okay, now God did this for a couple of reasons. There's a physical reason and a spiritual reason. Obviously, they did not have the refrigeration that we have today, so that, you know, if you leave meat out for a couple more than a couple of days, it's going to become rancid, it's going to become a disease, you're going to get sick on it. But the spiritual implication is this. when you make a dedication to God, this is something that, you know, it needs to be an ongoing thing. In other words, let's just say, like, if you were to offer a whole offering, a burnt offering, well, this is something that you do voluntarily, but it's something that we need to do continuously. In other words, you just don't dedicate your life to Christ and then just go along and do your own thing every other day. It's kind of like a renewed dedication every day. Every day is a new day, so you need to rededicate your life to God. I mean, the first thing I do when I get up in the morning, I put my head on my dresser and I say, Lord, I just offer this day up to you. I ask your richest blessings upon it. I ask you for your wisdom and guidance and direction, your protection upon this day. I ask you to help me give my part an honest day's work, keep me from making mistakes or breaking things, and help me get along with everybody, especially those in management. I pray for my children. I pray that, you know, God will protect them in their cars. I mean, in other words, I'm offering this up each day. That's what we need to do. It's kind of like a rededicating, it's kind of like a morning offering, in a sense, that you're offering the day up to God and have been praying for wisdom, guidance, and direction. And I think that that has something to do with it, too, that we can't just simply rest on past performances or past prayers. It's got to be a constant thing. And in verse 7, it says, so if it is eaten at all on the third day, it is an offense, it will not be accepted. In other words, the whole offering is not acceptable now because you violated what God has told you to do. And not only do you put yourself in danger of becoming sick on meat that can become rancid, but you haven't followed God's instructions, because what God is looking at is the spiritual significance of it, that you need to continue to rededicate and don't look back on things, on past performances. And then it says in verse 8, it says, and everyone who eats it will bear his iniquity, for he has profaned the holy thing of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from his people. And, you know, that's another application of this, too. You know, if we volunteer to do God's work in any way, shape, or form, I don't care whether it's teaching Sunday school or, you know, leading a choir or doing anything for the honor and glory of God, there really does need to be a commitment to that, to the point where you're doing your absolute best. In other words, you know, you just don't simply say, well, I'm going to teach Sunday school, and then you just go in there and shoot from the hip. You don't prepare. You don't really give it your all. You really do need to kind of reevaluate what you're dealing with in terms of serving God and saying, hey, you know, you've got to give it your best shot every single time, every single day that you're out there. And then he says here in verse 9, he says, and now when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, neither shall you gather gleanings of your harvest, nor shall you glean from your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the strangers. I am the Lord your God. Okay, now here's an interesting thing. Again and again and again, I think I mentioned this last week. God says here, I am the Lord your God, again and again and again. After he gives a specific command, he says, I am the Lord your God. And, you know, he says this actually dozens of times within the past, in the past chapter, this chapter, and the following chapter. He says it over and over again, as if to say to us, like, you know, I think every parent's had this experience where they tell their child to do something or not to do something, and the kid just simply says, well, why? And, you know, sometimes you just say, because I said so. In other words, you know, I don't need to give you an explanation. I'm the parent. You just simply do what I say. In a way, this is the way God is when he constantly says to him over and over again that I am the Lord thy God. In other words, I don't have to sit here and give you a long explanation as to why certain things need to be done that I'm commanding you to do or not, or forbidding you to do. You just simply got to recognize that I'm God, I know what I'm talking about, and you need to obey. And your obedience to me will show me that you love me. Mm-hmm. So basically, he's saying here in verse 9 and 10, he's saying, look, when you go through your fields, or you go through your orchards, you go through your vineyards, you can only go through one time. And when you go through with your servants or your hired help, your labor, you harvest, you know, your fruit or your grapes or your grain, whatever you harvest it all, then whatever's left over, you must leave for the poor and for the stranger, for the sojourner, or for the needy. And as a matter of fact, they were to leave the corners of the field unharvested, so it could be left there for the poor and the needy, mm-hmm. and the stranger and the sojourner. And I think that's very, very important, you know, for us to recognize what God had in mind here. Okay, he's actually made a provision for poor people. But what's interesting about it is that the poor people still had to go out there and, you know, harvest it themselves. Nobody was going to go out there and pick the fruit for them or the grapes for them or harvest the grain for them and go knock on their door and say, well, here's your portion. Unfortunately, when the government gets involved in trying to help people, so often what they do is just really undermine a person's dignity because they end up trying to give them the fruit of somebody else's labor. Now, I want to make a clear distinction here, okay? This does not apply to people who are truly in need in a sense that they cannot go out there in the fields to do it for themselves. But any able-bodied person who is first certainly capable of getting off their rear end and going out there and providing for themselves or doing some work, then God expects them to do that. Other people who, let's say, are too old or too feeble or too sick, well, then God expects people to help take care of them, all right? But unfortunately, in a situation like we see in our welfare system, for example, you know, there's some people who are needy enough. Well, yeah, they should get that kind of assistance. But unfortunately, too many people are on the public dole that don't do anything. And that's really bad for them and for the government, for everything else. We need to have these people go out and do something to earn this money. I don't care if it's cleaning the highways or doing whatever. But then, of course, then you get the lawyers involved. You get the ACLU involved who will object to that as being cruel and unusual somehow, when in reality, it really gives a person dignity. And, you know, this is what God – this is God's means of taking care of the needy and the orphan and the widow. But they still have to do their part. So you see the wisdom of that. Then he says here in verse 11, it says, you shall not steal, nor steal falsely, nor lie to one another. You know, again, he throws in, you know, the seventh commandment, thou shalt not steal. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of ways to steal. You don't just have to reach into a person's pocket to pick it. You can steal from your employer by failing to put in an honest day's work or, you know, taking extended breaks or whatever. Or you deal falsely. There's all kinds of ways to deal falsely, you know, through cheating or whatever. It says, nor lie to one another. The Bible says that in Proverbs, there's seven things that God hates. One of them is a lying tongue. And sometimes it's not that easy. I'll give you an example. I'm really praying about the possibility of maybe retiring this year and then, you know, getting a different job. And I got a cousin who's in kind of an overseer, a big shot in Placer County, and he was just over the other night talking to me, and he said that there might be a job available that I might be interested in, and then I thought, well, this is really great. But then, here's the clincher. It's, I guess on the application, they asked, are you related to anybody? So I think, you know, it would be very easy for me to just say, well, no. But I was kind of bummed out because I thought, well, I'm just not going to do it. I'm just not going to lie, you know, because, you know, if I get it, fine. If I don't, but see, there's a price to pay. The chances are I won't get in now. Okay. But I just have to just say, okay, you know, I'm just not going to do it. And sometimes that's what you have to do. You have to just determine that I'm just going to tell the truth, even though it's far more expedient to be able to lie. And he says here, in verse 12, it says, and you shall not swear falsely by my name so as to profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. Swear falsely by my name. I mean, interesting thing. You know, that 11 and 12 kind of can go together because you almost see how sin can be very progressive. In other words, if you steal from somebody, well, what you've done is you dealt falsely with that person. And then if you're accused of stealing from them, then you end up lying about it. And then when you're pressed about it, then you end up swearing falsely about it, saying, I swear to God, I didn't take that. See what I'm saying? You see how one sin can lead to another, to another, to another. But also when you swear falsely by my name, it's if we commit our life to Christ, then to dishonor his name is to basically take his name in vain or to swear falsely by his name if we're not going to obey him, in a sense. And then it's in verse 13, it says, you shall not oppress your neighbors nor rob him. The wages of a hired man are not to remain with you all night until the morning. In other words, if you owe a person money, you need to pay him and pay him in a timely manner. You need to pay him on time because if you don't, you're basically stealing from him. You see what I'm saying? You know, you can't just say, well, the check's in the mail because the guy's depending upon payment. And, you know, I've seen and heard, you know, throughout the years, we've had a lot of guys come through this study who have been in construction. I've heard all kinds of horror stories where these guys, you know, invest so much money in working for somebody, either constructing, either putting up patios or putting up houses or whatever, and they're expecting to get paid, and they keep getting put off. Well, that's stealing. Mm-hmm. You know, God says you need to pay what you owe, and you need to pay it in a timely manner. Otherwise, you put that other person in a real bind. And in verse 14, it says, you shall not curse a deaf man, nor place a stumbling block before the blind, but you shall revere your God. I am the Lord. Again, he says, I'm the Lord. I'm just telling you this. But when we read this, I think most people would look at this and say, well, wouldn't that be obnoxious for a person to curse a deaf man or to try to trip up put a stumbling block before a blind man? I'm telling you something. There's a spiritual application here, but there's also the physical. And I'm saying this over and over again, that inside of people's hearts, we have a fallen nature, and there's no end to the depravity that a man will sink apart from God. And what I'm saying here is that I can almost see this, a blind man going along the road, and then let's just say some worthless punk kids, you know, are sitting there thinking, oh, well, let's have some fun with him. So they put something in a stick before him and trip him up because they want to prove themselves to their buddies, look like, hey, you know, I have a good time here at the expense of this, you know, this poor handicapped person. Mm-hmm. Well, that's obnoxious in God's eyes. You really anger and offend God and sin against God when you show total disrespect for not only his servants, but for people, you know, who are handicapped or people who are needy. Or when you add insult to injury like that, boy, you are really bringing down God's wrath. And so when you curse a deaf man, you think you're being funny because he can't hear you, but everybody else is standing around here and hearing you cursing it, and they get a big laugh out of it. Well, that's mocking God. Because this person is created in his image and likeness. And it shows such disrespect for those created in the image and likeness of God. And this is the kind of society that we're living in now. We have become so uncivil. We have become so, you know, hardened to feeling empathy or compassion or concern for other people. We've become so selfish and so self-centered and self-seeking that more and more we are seeing this in our society, a total disregard for other people. Okay, and this is what God, it really angers God. He says, you shall not curse a deaf man nor place a stumbling block before a blind man. Well, you could also do this spiritually speaking. You could put a stumbling block before a blind man. Okay, if a person is spiritually blind, then a stumbling block would be if you claim to belong to Christ, claim to know the truth, but then you yourself become a stumbling block because of the way you live. You can cause other people, you know, to sin. Mm-hmm. And that's very, very important. I don't know how many times I've prayed in my life. I've just said, God, Lord, I just beg you, just take my life rather than ever permit me to sin in such a way that it's going to cause your enemies to blaspheme or cause my brothers and sisters to stumble. And I'm telling you right now, I'm just a man with feet of clay. I'm just flesh and bone. And if David could sin against God the way he did, then there's no hope for a man like me. That's why I say that prayer, because it's so important that we don't become a stumbling block for other people. Then it says here in verse 15, you shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. Isn't this something that's totally lost in our society today? Look at this. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. Well, this is something that's just a totally foreign to our judicial system today. Totally foreign. I mean, if you are famous, you are a celebrity, if you got money, then chances are you can get off. But then again, it says if you're poor, then a lot of times you can get away with a lot of stuff that other people wouldn't get away with. You know, there was the woman of justice, or statue of justice, I don't know what to call it, but it's a woman that stands there with a balance scale on her hand, in one hand, a sword in her other hand, and a blindfold on her. Well, I think it's very, very symbolic in what it means, in that the fact that she's got a blindfold on shows that she doesn't see whether a person is rich or poor or famous or just a nobody, or whether they are educated or whether they're illiterate or whatever. And they're blind to all that, okay? They're not blind to the facts, but they're blind to a person's state in life. Mm-hmm. But then they hold the balance scale showing that they're weighing out precisely the evidence that's there. And then, of course, the sword is there for acting in swift judgment. But why is it portrayed as a woman?
Mercy.
Good, good. Because, you know, there also needs to be a temper with mercy. But the problem is today, when you have too much mercy, it becomes injustice. There's no question about it. And then you have, when justice is delayed, it's justice denied. And this is what we're seeing in our court system today, just this total breakdown of justice in our society. 16, you shall not go about as a slanderer among your people, and you are not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. Again, he clarifies this as saying, I am the Lord. In other words, I'm telling you to do it. You don't need a long explanation. Just don't do it. You know what? Don't do what? Go about as a slanderer among your people. Don't be putting other people down, gossiping about them, slandering behind their back, saying evil things about them. I mean, it goes without saying. I mean, the Bible talks about, has an awful lot to say about people who will kill another person, but, you know, you can also assassinate another person with your tongue, and the Bible has an awful lot to say about a person's tongue, and that, you know, a person who can control their tongue becomes a perfect man. And sometimes it's very, very, very difficult to bite our tongue when we would like very much to say some derogatory thing about somebody, isn't it? But he says, don't go around as a slanderer among your people, because a slanderer is going to do what? He's going to sow seeds of resentment or bitterness or discord or hatred or animosity or jealousy. Or he can sow all kinds of things that are going to reap a harvest of just total bitterness. No question about it. And you are not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You know, when you start slandering a person, you're really assassinating his character. I mean, when you assassinate a person's character, then you might as well have taken his life. You know what I'm saying? You know, there's some things that people are accused of that they would rather die. In other words, if they're innocent and they're being slandered or something, especially today, let's just say that you are innocent, but somebody slanders you as being, let's say, a child molester or something. I mean, they might as well have taken your life. You see what I'm saying? How you can destroy a person's life with a slander like that? You know? And verse 17 says, you shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but you shall not incur sin because of it. I think this is very, very good, and the way it's worded here. You don't hate your fellow countrymen, but if he's doing something wrong, then God wants you to reprove him. In other words, God is saying here, I don't want you to harbor any contemptuous spirit towards anyone, especially your brother. In other words, when he talks about your fellow countrymen, he's talking about the application is in the church. You're not to hate your fellow brother or sister in Christ. But if they've done you wrong or they're doing something wrong, then you really do have an obligation to reprove them, to rebuke them, to point out to them what they're doing wrong and what they're failing to do. But the thing is, you've got to make every effort not to develop a contemptuous spirit towards them, because even Jesus says, if you say to your brother, thou fool, or raka, which means thou fool, you are guilty, you are in danger of hellfire. In other words, it shows that you have an animosity, a contempt, a hatred in your heart towards another person. And we all struggle with this. I mean, I struggle with this with a guy at work. I cannot stand this guy. I just can't stand him, you know. He's obnoxious. He's belittling. He's in your face. He's just treats you with a kind of like a contempt. And, you know, I have to pray about it every day just dealing with him. I really do. And, you know, the thing is, I go out of my way to try to pray that, first of all, I pray for his salvation. I pray for his spiritual and temporal needs. But he's the type of person I just try to avoid, but I just don't like being around him. Okay? But I pray all the time that I will not develop any kind of contemptuous spirit towards him, because if I do, then I'm in danger of hellfire. I'm just simply have got to love him, okay, even though I don't like him. You know, that's that simple. And then it says here in verse 18, it says, you shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. The two go hand in hand here. But again, when somebody asked Jesus, what's the greatest commandment? He says, love God with your whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. And seconds like it, love your neighbor as yourself. And, you know, can you imagine the kind of world we would live in if people would do this? They'd love their neighbor as themselves. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, to me, it would be heaven on earth. It would be absolute utopia. But people, they don't give a rat's behind about their neighbors, about other people. It's just a real crying shame. But if they did love their neighbors as themselves, you know, then it would be such a beautiful world to live in. There's no question about it. But that's what it boils down to. But Jesus actually quoted this particular passage here, when he says, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself, I am the Lord. This is the second greatest commandment, according to Jesus. And then we can see the wisdom of that, can't you? Mm-hmm. And then he says in verse 19, you are to keep my statutes, you shall not breed together two kinds of your cattle. You shall not sow your field with two kinds of seed, nor wear a garment upon you with two kinds of materials mixed together. Now, this is something that I think would fall under the ceremonial laws in this respect, because it doesn't fall under the moral laws, but there's a profound spiritual moral principle that's involved here. Okay, when it says, read it again, you shall not breed together two kinds of your cattle, not sow in your field two kinds of seed, nor wear a garment upon you with two kinds of materials mixed together. So, what the spiritual significance of that is this. We are told in the New Testament where Paul talks about, hey, what does Baal or Satan have in common with Christ? What does light have in common with darkness? When we look at this, what God is saying here, do not mix truth with lies. Do not mix the clean with the unclean. Do not, in other words, this is a spiritual principle, because this is what can cause so much confusion in the world. Because what God is dealing here is he's dealing with confusion. Okay, you got two different kind of cattle and trying to breed them together, it's going to bring confusion. You try to sew a garment with two different types of material. It doesn't apply to us today. What God is trying to impose here is this. Look, I'll give you an example. You know what's one of the most confusing things to a world that needs light? Is when you have the church that doesn't stand up for truth, and instead it stands up for what is untrue or what is false or what is wrong. And I'll give you an example. I just was listening to one of these radio talk show hosts yesterday, and apparently one of the rabbis, I don't know if they're Orthodox Jews or whatever, he has come out and he said that we are no longer going to give any money or contributions to the Boy Scouts of America because of their refusal to allow homosexuals into their group. Now, this is supposed to be a religious group, and there's also a number of churches who have done the same thing, and also a number of people who are pastors, ministers, priests, or whoever, who go along with this. So what I'm saying is this. When you have a situation when the church itself begins to mix truth with error, begins to compromise, or begins to mix all these together, doesn't it cause confusion throughout for everybody who doesn't know the truth? Mm-hmm. Or even people who know the truth and then they get confused about it because they're not really well ingrained in the truth? Mm-hmm. This is where this all points to, is the fact that, hey, we can really undermine the will of God by mixing right with wrong, good and evil, clean and unclean, what's true and what's false. Mm-hmm. And you see that so much in the church today. The church is guilty of a sin with this, because you see more and more of these pastors, these ministers, or these priests that are coming out and they're saying, well, we should, encompass, we should be not just tolerant, but we should be totally accepting of the homosexuals and their lifestyle. Okay? Now, the Bible makes it abundantly clear that God loves the homosexual. But we have to stand up for what is true and say, hey, this is, according to God, not according to man, this is wrong. This is an abomination. Yeah. This is sin. And if you don't repent of it, you're going to be damned. And the same thing can be said of an adulterer, a fornicator, a murderer, a thief, a rapist, a child molester. And the list can go on and on and on and on, because God makes it gives us a list in the New Testament, okay, which includes these sins. But when the church comes out and they begin defending this lifestyle, then what you're doing is you're crossbreeding truth with error. Mm-hmm. See what I'm saying? That's the spiritual principle here. Mm-hmm. Mixing materials together can cause so much confusion. And then verse 20 says, now if a man lies carnally with a woman who is a slave acquired for another man, but who has in no way been redeemed, nor given her freedom, there shall be punishment. They shall not, however, be put to death because she was not free. Okay, this was back when slavery was very, very common, as well as polygamy, and God recognized that in a certain situation, if a man owned a slave girl, well, he owned her, but then he was to lie with her. Well, the punishment for him wouldn't be death, but he would still have to be forgiven by making a hefty sacrifice to God under those circumstances, because in a sense, he did own her, but he obviously sinned against God by violating her because she was going to be belong to somebody else. All right, but it wasn't the same thing as adultery because this was a slave that he owned. Now, this obviously doesn't even apply today because slavery is a thing in the past, at least for the Jews and for so many other parts of the country, the world rather. And then he says in verse 21, and he shall bring his guilt offering to the Lord to the doorway of the tent of meeting, a ram for a guilt offering. The priest shall make atonement for him with the ram of the guilt offering before the Lord for his sins which he has committed. And the sin which he has committed shall be forgiven him. So obviously he has to owe up to it. He has to make restitution. He has to, you know, ask God to forgive him for what he's done, recognizing that, hey, you know, I've taken a liberty here that obviously I've crossed over a line and I need to make atonement for it. In verse 23 it says, and when you enter your into the land and plant all kinds of trees for food, then you shall count their fruit as forbidden. 3 years it shall be forbidden to you, it shall not be eaten. But in the fourth year all of its fruit shall be holy, an offering praise to the Lord. And in the fifth year you are to eat its fruit, that its yield may increase for you. I am the Lord your God. Now this is, again, this is a command that we're no longer bound by. But we see the wisdom in it. When you plant an orchard, for example, the best thing to do is to let the tree have a chance to mature. Let it have a chance to grow. What it's saying here is let it grow for 3 years. And then in the fourth year, the fruit that you take off the tree, you give it to God. It's the first fruits. And by the fifth year, then everything will be yours. Okay? And you'll have an abundant crop by the fifth year. And if there's a spiritual application, I would have to say, this could also apply in this sense. And I hope I'm not stretching this point too far. But look at new Christians, for example. They need a growing period, a maturing period, before their fruit can really begin to be produced. Okay, even Paul, he tells us when he became converted, there was a time in his early conversion where he actually went off, I think, for 14 years in the Arabian desert where Christ taught him, and he really needed to mature and to grow in the love and the knowledge of God. I know I've seen this happen time and time again, especially years ago when I used to go into Bible bookstores all the time. I used to see all of these books by celebrities or sports figures, athletes. And you'd see their picture, whether it be football or basketball or baseball, and they'd be this sports figure who had accepted Christ. Well, you know, as soon as they accepted Christ, it's like, wham, they're thrown into the limelight. They're brand new Christians in the Lord, and they're pushed out there in a way to say, hey, look, here's a guy everybody knows. He's become a Christian, you know, and I think this is really going to be a good witness. Well, 90% of the time, these guys end up falling on their face or eventually going back into the world or backsliding back to where they were, but they got this book on the market like they've committed their life to Christ. Why? Because they, you know, they were pushed out in the limelight without being mature enough. Mm-hmm. And as a result, where are they now? They become more of a stumbling block than an asset, or, you know, more of a liability, so to speak. And I think the church has a lot to answer there, because it's simply because a person may be famous. Don't push them out in the limelight. Say, hey, man, you got a lot of growing, a lot of maturing to do, and when your time comes, I think God will open a door and you can be a real asset to his kingdom. But to just throw them out in the middle limelight, it's like, hey, you know, the chances are they're not going to make it. So there needs to be that time of growth and times of maturity. And then he says in verse 26, you shall not eat anything with the blood, nor practice divination or soothsaying. Mm-hmm. Eat anything with the blood was to show that, hey, it was to show a disregard for the fact that God has sovereignty over all of life. That's why the blood had to be poured out before you could eat an animal, showing that God is sovereign, that you do not have dominion over life. Only God does. Only God has that authority to take a life. Now, sure, he allowed people to kill animals to eat, but the pouring out the blood was symbolically showing that, hey, even though I'm allowed to eat this, I don't have dominion over it. Only God does, over its life. And to eat the blood was a defiance of that. Okay? And you just not practice divination or soothsaying. Divination and soothsaying, that's an attempt to tell the future. And there's all kinds of ways to try to people try to tell the future. I mean, people get into soothsaying. I mean, there's all kinds of ancient practices that would go from cutting up cats and throwing out their entrails out on the floor or the ground and trying to discern what, you know, as it, the way they would fall, what the future is going to hold. Today, this is the same thing, whether it's tarot cards or Ouija boards or astrology or horoscopes or crystal balls, whatever, all of this falls under divination and soothsaying. And what you're involved with here is a spiritual realm where the devil can get in and deceive people. That's why God says, hey, you don't do this, period. Why? Because I'm the Lord your God. I'm not going to sit here and try to explain to you all the demonic forces that are at work here and that are going to mislead you. You just simply do what I tell you. You know? And in verse 27, you shall not round off the side growth of your beard, of your heads, nor harm the edges of your beard. Apparently, this was a kind of a cultic practice that the heathens would do. When it says here, you round off the side growth of your heads, the side growth of your head. I guess it was I don't know whether it would be kind of like a bowl cut or if it was dealing with the sideburns. Whatever it was, it had, you know, a heathen connotation to it. Whatever it was, it kind of set these people off as kind of being, whether they were astrologers or priests or, you know, into some kind of cultic thing, that kind of set them apart. But it also says here, nor harm the edges of your beard. That too identified certain individuals as being belonging to either a cult or in dealing with the cult or belonging to some kind of priesthood or something like that. It set them apart, you know. So God was saying, hey, don't get involved with that. Then he says there in verse 28, you shall not make any cuts in your body for the dead, nor make any tattoo marks on yourselves. I am the Lord. Again, he says, I'm the Lord. Because I tell you this, you know, you just simply do it. And he says here, don't make any cuts in your body for the dead. In other words, when a person died, it was a heathen practice to cut yourself to show mourning, to show sorrow, to show grief. And in some cases, they would cut themselves to try to appease their God, because a death actually was a calamity, and trying to appease their God by cutting themselves, they would hope to avoid the same fate. But like Paul tells us in the New Testament, we are not to grieve and we are not to weep like those who have no hope. Well, that's what these people would do. They would cut themselves for the dead. Well, that's a kind of a heathen practice. God says, don't have anything to do with that, because I'm the God of the living, not the God of the dead. But then there's also an interesting thing that he says here about, he says, nor make any tattoo marks on yourself. You know, there's something that I've just noticed, not recently, I've just been noticing it over the years, and more I'm noticing it. You notice today, more and more people are wearing tattoos, and now it's not just simply tattoos, now it's piercing, body piercing. And they're piercing everything from their nipples to their tongues to their eyelids to, they're piercing themselves all over. But you know what's interesting about that? I used to go through National Geographic magazines. I used to go through a lot of these other magazines. And you know what? The more primitive people are, the more they tattoo their bodies, or more they deform their bodies, the more they cut their bodies, the more they put scars upon their bodies or try to do all these different things to their body. You ever notice that? The more primitive of people are, the more they do this. And I'm seeing this becoming more and more commonplace in our culture. And what does it say to us? What does it say? It's really saying that we are becoming more and more primitive. Because what? We are becoming more and more controlled by demonic forces. And the more primitive a person, a society is, a culture is, the more they will debase their bodies. Mm-hmm. You see, the two go hand in hand. And when God says, don't tattoo your body. Now, again, if a person has a tattoo, it's not an unforgivable sin, okay? But you shouldn't tattoo your body, because it's a temple of the Holy Spirit. But not only that, the more we see this in our culture, and the more we see it worldwide, the more condition that people will become to what? The final tattoo is what?
The mark.
Mm-hmm. When God says, don't tattoo yourself, it's kind of like he told them 3,000 years ago, you know, what's coming. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a final tattoo that's going to be tattooed on a person. And I think the more the society gets into tattooing themselves and actually mutilating their bodies, the more readily they're going to be, just accept this. Mm-hmm. I personally believe that it will be a mark that you cannot see, because it will be done with invisible ink or something that will need to be manifested through ultraviolet light or something like that. But still, it's a tattoo that's going to be put on a person. And then in verse 29 says, do not profane your daughter by making her a harlot, so that the land may not be full of harlotry and the land become full of lewdness. Okay, he says you could profane your daughter by you know, making her play the prostitute so that you can make a living. In other words, you're going to be kind of her pimp. Well, this is done quite often in third world countries. It really is. I was in the Marine Corps. I went down to Tijuana with a bunch of friends, and of course there was whores all over the place there. And the mothers and the fathers would be selling their daughters to make money, okay? Well, God forbids people to do that. Because what happens is that you end up polluting the land, and what he says here is that the land becomes full of lewdness. Today, there's a big push to legalize prostitution. And in some places in the country, it is legalized. All right, and there's always the argument that, well, if you legalize prostitution, then you can do away with a lot of the crime element, and you can do away with a lot of the diseases because the government will have control over it. You can do. I mean, there's always the logic there that will be put forth for legalizing prostitution, right? Yeah. It's the same thing when James talked about there's a wisdom from above and a wisdom, you know, that's earthly. A wisdom that's earthly and sensual and demonic. That's the wisdom of the world. And the wisdom of the world says, hey, legalize prostitution because it had a lot of good benefits to it, right? But that's not the wisdom from above that is pure and holy and peaceful and whatnot, okay? When man looks at something and he tries to say, well, this would be good because it could eliminate this problem, that problem. He only creates more problems, okay? And if you legalize prostitution, what you end up doing is you end up polluting the land with lewdness. In other words, it will breed crime and corruption and more immorality and more ungodliness. And there will be, you know, everything is breeded along with that, including disease and murder and everything else that goes with it. Okay, the land will be polluted if you promote prostitution. That's what God's basically saying. Verse 30, you shall keep my Sabbath and revere my sanctuary. I am the Lord. Again, he's throwing in another commandment here. Now, the Sabbath, I know that there are churches today like the Seventh-day Adventists, they absolutely insist that we have to do it on the Sabbath day, worship on the Sabbath day. Well, you know, the New Testament makes it abundantly clear that we are no longer bound by, you know, certain days of the week and certain feast days or certain days according to the cycles of the moon and so on and so forth. The important thing to recognize is every day is a Sabbath day for us in this respect. Every day is the Lord's day. But for the Christian, it's the first day of the week, which is Sunday, and that's what we worship on. Well, keep something in mind. Keep my Sabbath, revere my sanctuary, I am the Lord. The important thing is that God wants that honor that is his due on a weekly basis, to set aside time to revere his name, rear sanctuary. In other words, go to a sanctuary, assemble together. You just can't simply say, well, you know, I'm going to worship God my own way. I'm going to go out there and be part of nature and all this other stuff. He says here, revere my sanctuary. Wow, by keeping my Sabbath. It's very important that we understand it. For example, if you broke the Sabbath, it was a very, very serious thing. As a matter of fact, I think we read it in Exodus where there was a man who was gathering firewood on the Sabbath day. Remember? And people turned him into Moses, and Moses asked God, well, what should we do with this man who's gathering firewood on Sabbath? And God had him stoned to death. And, of course, we look at that, and we really, you know, we go, holy smoke. I mean, the guy was just collecting firewood. You know, give him a break. But God wanted to instill in his people a very profound spiritual message or principle here. And that's that, hey, our Sabbath is resting in the finished work of Christ. And anybody who doesn't rest in the finished work of Christ, in other words, they try to be saved by Christ plus. In other words, trying to do something on their own to be saved. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's only going to meet with death. You know, try to get to heaven by being a good person. Well, you're as good as dead spiritually. You are as good as gone to hell. Try to get to heaven by just simply being good. You know, and yet this whole world, especially this country and the society of ours, you know, people have this cockamamie notion that I'm basically good, and if I die, I'll go to heaven, if there is a heaven. I mean, this is the kind of, you know, shallow mentality that people have. They recognize that, hey, the truth is, I'm a sinner from the get-go, and I need to put my faith in the finished work of Jesus Christ, because I recognize that I cannot get to heaven by, quote-unquote, being good, because I'm no good. But that's the importance of keeping the Sabbath. And in verse 31 says, do not turn to mediums or spiritists. Do not seek them out or be defiled by them. I am the Lord your God. Now, he's saying don't turn to mediums. What's a medium?
Some channels.
evil, yeah, demonic spirits.
Right, a person who is basically a go-between, a medium between the spiritual realm and the physical realm. You get into a situation where people get into seances, for example. There will be a person who will act as a medium, and they will sit there, and they will go into a trance, and they will actually become possessed by a devil, a demon, okay? And if they're in this seance, if they're trying to conjure up, quote-unquote, their dead aunt, bozo, whoever it is they're trying to get in contact with, this spirit will begin speaking through this medium. But it's not the person themselves. It is a deceiving spirit that's speaking through this medium. In other words, a medium is a go-between the spiritual realm and the physical realm. You know, and I know there are a lot of charlatans and there are a lot of fakes and a lot of phonies out there who try to put on fake seances, but there's also a lot of real, you know, spiritual phenomena that takes place. So God says, stay away from these things. Stay away from the spiritists. In other words, these are people who are trying to conjure up the dead. Okay? Now, God doesn't explain to them why, because you'll be dealing with demons and you won't be dealing with dead people. You won't be dealing with the ghost of a deceased loved one. You'll be dealing with deceiving spirits. He didn't tell them that. He just said, don't do it. Period. Okay? And then he says here in verse 32, he says, you shall rise up before the gray-headed and honor the aged. You shall revere your God. I am the Lord. Okay, man, aren't we a far cry from this today? He says, you shall rise up before a gray-headed man. You know, if a gray-headed guy was walking down a road and you were sitting there talking to your friend, you need to rise up to recognize him, to show respect, to show reverence to the aged person. God wanted to instill that in them, to show this kind of respect for the elderly, because the elderly, you know, carried with them a great deal of wisdom and insight and understanding through their experiences and so on and so forth. Well, look at today, there's so little respect for elderly people. There isn't a hard name. But I could see why. Because there's no respect for the unborn. There's not going to be any respect for the elderly when we have a total disregard for human life in the womb. There's going to be a total disregard for life at the end of the lifespan as well, and not to mention all the way in between. But this is one thing that would show in a culture where you show respect for your elders, there's going to be a civility that's pervasive throughout society. And he says here, and honor the aged, and you shall revere your Lord, your God. Because basically the aged, you know, in a sense, they stand in the place of God as well, okay? And in verse 33, it says, when a stranger resides with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. That's pretty self-explanatory, but it would be easy for a stranger, in other words, for a foreigner to come into your land, and then you treat him with as a second-class citizen, or you treat him with contempt, or you treat him with prejudice, or treat him with disdain, or take advantage of him, or, you know, this type of thing. Mm-hmm. Well, God says, hey, you're not to do that. Why? Because you're a stranger. Is, again, somebody who's created in the image and likeness of God. What you do unto him, you do unto the Lord. And Jesus himself said in the New Testament, if you can give a cold glass of water in my name to the least of my brethren, you've done it to me. Okay? And then it says in verse 34, the stranger who resides with you shall be to you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you are aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. In other words, look at our society today, okay? We are torn apart, aren't we? And this is a judgment from God. We are so torn apart with racism and division. And I don't care whether it's a black or white. I don't care whether it's male or female. I don't care whether it's rich or poor. I don't care whether it's Democrat or Republican. I don't care what it, I mean, there are multitudes and multitudes of divisions in this country where the chasm is so wide, there's no unifying us. There is absolutely no unifying. And you know why? It's a judgment from God. Because we have turned our back on God, then the natural outcome of that is we've become more and more uncivil towards each other, and more these divisions are going to become prevalent among us. Okay? And you look at what's happening today, and it's a sad state of affairs, and you can see so much contempt and so much hatred among the races. But if we really, you know, we're trying to honor God, we will be showing respect and love and consideration for a neighbor, even if they are foreigners, even if they don't speak our own language or whatever. And then in verse 35, it says, you shall do no wrong in judgment in measurements of your weight or capacities. In other words, you're not to cheat anyone. That's simple, all right? It's very straightforward. That, you know, you everything you do is to be with integrity and honesty. And unfortunately, that's all gone out the window, too, because, you know, how many people today, you know, are being cheated in so many different ways? I mean, it's almost proverbial. You don't want to go to a used car place to buy a car. Why? Because you just know you're going to be flim-flam and lied to and jerked around and sold a bill of goods. And a lot of people don't want to go to a mechanic today because, you know, they're going to be ripped off and told they need things they don't need, right? Or, you know, how many people don't want to, you know, have somebody come in and do any work on their house because they know they're going to be lied to. They know they're going to, their bill's going to be padded. I mean, this is all the end result of selfishness and greed and deceit and lying. You know, this all falls together where it says, you shall do no wrong in judgment. Oh, gosh, look at our judicial system. And measurements of weight or capacity. In verse 36, you shall have just balances, just weights, and just FF and a just hin. An FF was a bushel, and a hin, I think, was something like 2 quarts or a liquid measure. I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Again, the 35 and 36 simply go together. Okay? It says an awful lot, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Give me a person with character any day over a person with ability. Because I can always teach somebody to do their job, but I can't teach a person character. You know what I mean? It's that simple. You can't teach a person who's got all the ability in the world how to be honest if they're not honest. You know what I mean? If they got no character, then forget it. Verse 37, he says, you shall thus observe all my statutes and all my ordinances and do them, I am the Lord. In other words, hey, you just don't pick and choose here. Don't pick and choose. You can't just go through this thing and say, well, you know, this is okay. I can do this. I can do that. But this doesn't apply to me. Or I don't want this to apply to me, so I'm not going to do it. Okay? It's all or nothing as far as God is concerned. Anybody have anything you want to add or share? Believe it or not, I really wanted to go through 2 chapters tonight, but we just don't have the time. Because it's just, there's just no way.
What were you thinking?
I don't know. We got started late, but I...